From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. In our ongoing attempt to make sense of the United States under Donald Trump, we turn today to the author of a new book that promises hope that a concerted group of dedicated Americans can salvage the nation out of the president's vice grip. D.D. Guttenplan was the lead reporter during the 2016 election for The Nation magazine, and his new book, The Next Republic, chronicles how 9 activists have worked to change the course of the U.S. and how their work offers a path for survival. His earlier books include The Holocaust on Trial and American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone. And the name of the new full name of the new book is The Next Republic, The Rise of a New Radical Majority. Welcome to the program, Don.
Great to be here, Sonali.
So you chronicle the stories and profile these 9 activists, the first of whom is a labor organizer who warned you in Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention that she wasn't quite so sure that Hillary Clinton would prevail over Donald Trump. You had a little bit more information than the rest of us in following the election. Who is the activist? And how did she know what Trump would do?
Unlike a lot of people, I can't say I wasn't warned. In 2016, I actually was at the convention, and I was having dinner with Jane McAlevey, who's actually a California-based activist. She lives in San Francisco in San Francisco. But she was doing some work for the nurses' unions in Philadelphia. And she said to me, we were talking about the coming Clinton administration, and I was predicting how various leftist groups would try and steer Clinton in a more progressive direction, but that it wasn't going to be easy. And she basically said, whoa, not so fast. I remember the phrase she used was, she hasn't sealed the deal. Hmm. And her point was that she spent all of her days talking to women about politics because she was doing organizing with a nurses union, and the women she talked to were not wholly sold on Hillary Clinton. So, and this was in Pennsylvania, and I thought, boy, if she can't be sure of winning in Pennsylvania, then the Democrats are in trouble. But I have to say that I didn't take Jane's warning as seriously as I should have. Anyway, she's the first chapter in my book because the subtitle of her chapter is Winning in Conditions of Extreme Adversity. And I think that's where we are. We're in a time of extreme adversity. And Jane's work, which has to do with what she calls whole worker organizing. So it isn't just about organizing about job conditions or pay or at the workplace. It's about doing power structure analysis to show what power the bosses can bring to bear on you in any given situation. For example, the people who own the hospital or run the hospital or serve on the board of the hospital, but also what power the workers have and can mobilize. So where do they worship? What sports do they play? Who's on their sports teams? What neighborhoods do they live in? What are the community organizations? And her point is that workers have a lot of social capital, and if they mobilize all of it, they can win strikes even in right-to-work states. I mean, I first met Jane. I'd been reading her work for years in The Nation and elsewhere, but I first met her because I was going to Nevada to report on the Nevada primary for The Nation, and I knew that she had been a key organizer in the hospital workers' unions in Nevada, and she knew the state. So I rang her up and said, you know, can you tell me some people to see? And that gave me a sense of how deep she drilled into the communities where she was working and her sense of how all these things fit together. And I thought that's really important, that we're never going to get anywhere just by trying to. She also talks about the difference between organizing and mobilizing, in that a lot of what traditional Democrats and Democratic Party organizations and even labor unions do is they mobilize, which means getting the people who already support you to show up, whether it's on a picket line or to vote or to do a telephone banking for a candidate. And her point is that that's never going to be enough to win, that what we need to do is to organize, and that organizing means talking to people who don't already agree with you. And that a lot of us in the left have gotten very comfortable just talking to ourselves and to each other. And that's nice and it's cozy, but it's not going to change the country. In order to change the country and to change the world and to have real power, we're going to have to take the risk of talking to people who don't agree with us, who don't share all of our premises and prejudices and biases, and who aren't all nice, lovely, you know, organic gardening people who all are nation readers. You know, we have to talk to people who don't always share our views in order to convince them, and in order to convince them that they have a stake in this fight. So that's why she's the first chapter.
And has she been able to successfully lead labor struggles? Because we don't see that many successful labor struggles in our time these days. They do happen, but they're few and far between.
The thing that Jane's been on my case about for the past couple months is the LA teacher strike. She said this is going to be a big strike and it's going to be really tough, but if they win, it's going to be huge. So yeah, I mean, she's someone who works as a, she doesn't work for any one union, and part of that is because she wrote a book called Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, which was a memoir of her work inside one union, where she won lots of strikes and organized lots of workers, but also offended the union bosses and was fired. So she tends to be more of someone who consults with unions, but particularly unions that are about to strike, considering a strike, in a really tough fight. If you're in a tough fight, you want to get Jane. So, but yeah, she's done that in Nevada, in Pennsylvania, in Connecticut, and, you know, she's been very involved as an advisor to some of the people doing the LA teacher strike. So I would say, yeah, she's been able to do that.
Let's talk about the other person, one of the others that you profile, and that is Chokwe Antar Lumumba, who is the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. I remember when he was first elected, he was really seen as a rising star on the left. I suppose he offers a really great example of how one can actually use electoral politics, especially at the local level, to win.
That's right. Well, you know, the interesting thing about, to me, the reason that I was drawn to Antar, everybody calls him Antar because his father, who was also elected as mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, Chokwe Lumumba, was Chokwe Lumumba. But his father died after just a few months in office, and Antar ran to take his place and lost that election and didn't win until the next time. But what interested me about him is that he comes out of a black nationalist, black power background. And I thought that that's really interesting and I suppose challenging for me. If you're watching this on TV and not listening to it on the radio, you'll see that I'm a middle-aged white guy. So I was, like a lot of middle-aged white people on the left, brought up to think that black nationalism was a dead end. And, you know, that was definitely not Antar's view. It isn't his view. And he said he wanted to make Jackson, Mississippi, the most radical city in the country. Now, you know, he's only been in office for a little over a year. It's not clear yet how far he's going to get. He's facing immense opposition, as you can imagine, a black radical in the state of Mississippi, you know, the most racist state in the country. But I wanted to basically have to think about and to listen to someone whose premises were very different from mine. I guess I should step back for a minute and point out that the book is organized around two different kinds of chapters. One are profiles of activists like Antar Lumumba or Jane McAlevey, and there are six of those chapters. And then there are three historical chapters that talk about moments in our country's past when we had what you could call a government that was genuinely of the people, by the people, and for the people. And so I'm writing about what we accomplished in the past, what we were able to do, and why these past republics, I call them republics because it seems to me that American history has been a series of oscillations between republics and various kinds of oligarchy. And we're now definitely living through a period of extreme oligarchy, extreme polarization of wealth and power. And so the question is, how can we get to the next republic? How can we get to the next period? And one of the periods I talk about is the New Deal, for example, or I talk about the Lincoln Republic, the period right after the Civil War, when slavery had been abolished. So, you know, we have been able to do great things, and that's what the historical chapters are about. But the other point is that each of the profiles of the activists, the idea is that none of these people on their own have the answer. There is no one magic pill, magic bullet that is going to bring about a progressive rising in the United States. That what I have learned as a reporter who spent decades covering politics is that it's going to take all of these strands together. It's going to take a coalition. And so I was interested in talking to people who had a very strong analysis or a very strong base or a very strong sense of what they wanted to do and where they were coming from. And Antar is a perfect example of that. But who were also very much open to the idea of cooperating with, working with other people. They were not people who just wanted to stay in their silos. They were people who understood the need to build coalitions, to go outside of their comfort zone, to talk to people, as Jane always says, who don't agree with us. And so that's part of what he's doing in the book as well.
How much of the campaign around Bernie Sanders's presidential candidacy fed into the sort of coalition building that we now know is possible? I mean, Sanders came so much closer to winning that primary than any of us, or certainly the Democratic Party itself, ever imagined he would.
I say in the book that Bernie scared the hell out of the Democratic Party because I'm sure they were terrified that he might win. And I think he was surprised. I don't think he realized how far he was going to get. But a very good example of the way that the Sanders campaign feeds into where we are now, that very much features in my book, is a chapter that's about two young organizers, Waleed Shaheed and Corbin Trent. Now, Waleed, I met first because he was opening a Sanders office in South Philadelphia, and he stood up and gave a speech in which he talked about his father, who was a Pakistani immigrant to the United States, who worked in a parking garage as a parking attendant, and who worked hard, worked long hours for very low pay, but managed to save up some money and did what he was supposed to do under the rules of the American dream, and saved his money, worked hard, and put all his money into real estate, and bought a house and tried to fix it up, and then lost it all in the 2008 crash. And so Waleed's line in this speech was, "Who needs a political revolution? Why do we need a political revolution in this country? For people like my father." And it was just a tremendously moving, powerful speech. And he's a very, very smart young guy. So I started to stay in touch with him, see what he was doing, keep track of what he was doing. At the same time, I heard about these people everywhere I went covering the Sanders campaign. And I would go to these states that were not the early primary states. In the early primary states, like New Hampshire and Iowa, the national Sanders campaign would run things. But in states like Florida or Tennessee or, any state that was not one of the four early states, they didn't have enough staff to send people to those states. So what they would do is they would send they would have something called a Bernie Barnstorm. And that would basically be this guy, Corbin Trent, and another person, Zach Exley, and sometimes Becky Bond, and they would go out and they would run a sort of weekend-long training for whoever was interested in working for Bernie in that state, and they would say, "Look, this is how you do this. This is how you run a phone bank. Here's the software that you need to have people do calls. Here's the software you need to get the van, which is the kind of digital tool that political organizers use when you go door-to-door canvassing and door-knocking to collect data on, who's leaning, who favors your candidate, who's going to vote, who's not going to vote." So they showed people, they spent a weekend training people to use all these tools, and then they left. And the funny thing is that Bernie did better in the states where he had no national staff and where Becky and Zach were running things, and they were leaving it to the local people to run things. So their theory was called distributed organizing. And it basically meant give power to people at the local level, make a big ask them to really do the big jobs, and then leave them to it, and they'll deliver. And that's what happened. So I was very intrigued to meet Corbin, and I finally met him. He kind of bailed out of the Sanders campaign by July when it became clear that Bernie wasn't going to win. And I met him in Tennessee when he and Zach were starting a new venture, which at that point they called Brand New Congress. And the idea was to try and that the theory then was that, that Clinton was going to win, or even if she did win, that, that she was going to need, that Congress was not going to be willing to do anything really as radical as, for example, Medicare for all or free college tuition, you know, the things that Bernie had campaigned on, which were in the Democratic platform, but which we knew Clinton didn't really want to do. And we thought, well, she can always blame it on Congress if she gets in and she doesn't do it. So how do you get a Congress that really wants these things? And that's what they were starting to think about. And so I did some reporting and went out with them to some organizing meetings and stayed in touch with them. Eventually, they ran up against this problem, which is their original vision was to run Democrats in Democratic districts and Republicans in Republican districts, as long as the Republicans agreed to sign up to a set of, you know, core progressive values, because they thought there were what they called, you know, red Republicans out there who would do this. Now, I don't know about that. I don't know whether that was realistic or not. But in any case, they soon discovered that Act Blue, which is the thing that collects funds, wouldn't collect funds for Republican candidates. So they had to set up another organization called Justice Democrats, or they joined with another organization called Justice Democrats. And that's where both of them are still working out of. But the reason you might have heard of them and you might have heard of Justice Democrats or even Brand New Congress is because the first candidate they recruited, and I was with them when they were starting to try to recruit candidates, the first candidate they recruited was a young woman in the Bronx, New York, called Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And, you know, she was a long shot like all of their candidates, but she was very committed. And, you know, and there she is. Now she's in Congress and she's demanding all the things that people like us think are possible and indeed necessary. And it, in a sense, it all started from Bernie's campaign. So, yeah, his campaign was crucial. I guess the way I would point out what Bernie's campaign achieved is a sensation I had when I was in New Hampshire the night that Bernie won the primary there. And I was looking around the high school gym where he was having his victory rally. And I was astonished, but so was everybody else in that room. Not so much that he'd won the primary, but at how many of us there were. Because, you know, people who believe in universal health care, people who believe that you shouldn't go broke to go to college, you shouldn't graduate college overloaded with debt, people who believe that paid family leave is a human right, we have always been told that those beliefs are marginal, you know, that that makes us crazy socialists that are outside the mainstream. And yet what Bernie's campaign showed is that those beliefs are mainstream beliefs, that there are a lot of people who believe and want those things and think that they're possible and necessary and just, and that if you give people the chance to vote for them, they will.
Now, I want to bring up, because there's so much to talk about, we could go on for a long time, and people can certainly get a copy of your book, but one of the big issues that has come about, in addition to things like paid family leave, free college education, more and more Americans, and polls are showing this, take the issue of climate change seriously, are worried about the state of their environment. We have a deregulatory set of cabinet heads under the Trump administration that are undoing all of these protections. Tell us about the environmental activism that needs to be a part of this coalition building in this country and actually can succeed, because whether you're Republican or Democrat, when a hurricane sweeps away your home, you're affected.
You're affected. Well, that's right. So there's a chapter in my book called Jane Klebb, The Accidental Environmentalist. And Jane started out working for sort of young Democrats, and she was a kind of activist, but she wasn't really interested in the environment. She was interested in healthcare. And she lives in Nebraska, and she was hired to run a kind of program by the SEIU, the health, the union, the Service Employees International Union, to lobby or to mobilize or to organize people around the issue of healthcare to support Obamacare as it was trying to, as they were trying to get it passed, as they were looking for 60 votes, because Ben Nelson, the Democratic senator then from Nebraska, they thought was a possible vote for Obamacare. So how do they get to 60? They start organizing at the grassroots, and that's what they, that's what she was hired to do. But it just so happened that her husband works on a ranch. And so she knows a lot of people who work on ranches, and she knows a lot of ranchers in Nebraska. It's a big cattle state. And the reason it's a big cattle state is that it sits right on top of something called the Oglala Aquifer, which is the biggest source of drinking water in the United States. It supplies about a third of the water for all of American agriculture. And it's right there in Nebraska. And what would happen is when she would be talking to people about healthcare, they would keep wanting to talk to her about this thing, the Keystone Pipeline, which they were worried about because it was going to come right, cut right across their fields. And so eventually Jane got pulled in to organizing. The landowners, the ranchers, went to her and said, "Will you come with us to meet with these oil company people who are trying to sign us up to have the right to run their pipeline across our land?" And in doing that, she learned more and more about Keystone and its potential impact and the potential danger it would pose to the state where she lived, where she and her husband Scott were raising their kids. And eventually what happened is she led the effort to stop the Keystone Pipeline in Nebraska, which is the state where they stopped it. And in order to do that, though, she had to put together, again, this goes back to the theme of my book, she had to put together this really unlikely coalition of landowners, ranchers, many of whom are not only Republican, Nebraska is a Republican state, but also pretty conservative people on most political issues, and Native Americans, because it was the Native Americans who were the earliest, had the earliest consciousness of the danger of these pipelines, and who were the most motivated to fight them, and who were kind of the canaries in the coal mine, if you like, about the danger posed by climate change, carbon-based fuels, all of those things, because you know they have a different and deeper relationship with the environment than most of us who don't live on the land in the same way, who live in cities. So they put together this coalition. They went to Washington. They demonstrated. They lobbied. And eventually Obama signed this thing saying that the Keystone Pipeline wasn't in the national interest. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the first thing Trump did literally on his first day in office was sign an executive order saying the Keystone Pipeline should go ahead. But they're still fighting it. And in fact, in court, they keep winning. So far, our side is winning. And it's, again, it's partly this thing that you have to understand that the environment has to be part of our politics, and that in fighting for the environment and fighting against climate change, you begin to realize that the enemy isn't one bad person or some bad people or Donald Trump, that the enemy is corporate domination. The enemy are the big oil companies and the big corporations who are pushing through things like Keystone, and that in order to fight against environmental depredation and against destroying our planet, you have to mobilize to fight against overweening corporate power and corporate greed. So you have to have a critique of corporate power as part of your politics. And that's another chapter in my book, a woman called Zephyr Teachout, who recently ran in the primary in New York City and lost, I mean, in New York State and lost, but who's also the lead plaintiff on the emoluments lawsuit against Donald Trump, saying he's been accepting money from foreign governments at his hotel and other things illegally. Because Zephyr is one of the leading critics of corporate power in the United States. She literally wrote a book called Political Corruption, which is a history of political corruption in the United States. And so again, all these pieces have to fit together. You know, it's not one thing. It's not just environmental mobilizing. It's not just racial justice. It's not just economic justice. It's not just labor rights. It's all of these pieces have to come together.
Well, Don, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book. Hopefully people pick up a copy and get the full sense of it, reading it directly. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
My guest is D.D. Guttenplan, lead reporter during the 2016 election for The Nation magazine. His earlier books include The Holocaust on Trial and American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone. We've been discussing his latest book, The Next Republic, The Rise of a New Radical Majority. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.